Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Jonathan Glazer joins the show to discuss his Oscar hopeful film, The Zone of Interest.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 299 of Real Blend, a podcast that wants to know, Kevin specifically, if you know Denis Villeneuve's favorite 1997 British musical comedy starring Alan Cumming, George Wendt, and Roger Moore. Denis Villeneuve has a very specific, beloved 1997 British musical comedy.
He's been talking about it the entire Dune tour, press tour.
It's true. He brings it up on every
more
interview.
Than Dune. He talks about it more than Dune.
He's like, yeah, part two is great, but have you seen?
It co-stars Alan Cumming, George Wendt of Cheers fame, and Sir Roger Moore, former James Bond.
I have absolutely no idea.
Jakey, any idea?
I am ready for this punchline, baby.
Spice World. Spice World.
Wait, the way you went around not naming
I can't
the
mention
Spice
them.
Girls,
if I name them, it gives it away.
Also, is Spice World a musical?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember that. I'm gonna be honest, I've never seen it.
Do you know what I remember the most about Spice World? I saw it at AMC Patrick Henry 7. Isn't there a scene where a bus like they cut to like a miniature bus like jumping over like a bridge or like a water? I'll never forget. Yeah.
The director calls it his sandworm scene. That's how he remembers it.
His Batmobile scene.
And it looks about as accurate as the ambulance jumping out of the Times Square billboard in Madame Web.
Right. Ooh. Right.
Also had 1997 special effects.
Hey.
Spice World. That's pretty funny, actually. I just didn't know where you were going with that. I don't remember I don't remember Roger Moore being in that movie. What? What?
This episode brought to you by Spice World. I'm Sean O'Connell, the managing editor of Cinema Blend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast. And on this week's show, one of our favorite directors is going to be taking over the Jurassic Park franchise, and we're going to talk about whether that has gotten us excited or not. And our guest is Jonathan Glazer, who joins the show to discuss his Oscar hopeful film, The Zone of Interest. I'm joined this week, as I am every single week, by Spice Girls fanatic Kev McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing good. I know everyone's tired of hearing me talk about Nolan, but I do just want to say I'm excited for the Tenet reissue this weekend.
You got tickets? Do you have tickets?
Oh, definitely. I'm going on Tuesday.
Sean, he's already seen it. He's already got tickets. It's already happened.
He's seeing it for the first time this weekend.
Yeah.
Dude, that actually would be a really cool. That'd be a cool segment for Real Blend. I just want to put it out there. Like, we should do a segment about a movie you'd love to see again for the first time. If you could,
we've talked about that. We've talked about that a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, maybe on a premium.
Kev, what happens if I don't understand Tenet though?
Don't try to understand it. Feel it, Sean. I've been trying to explain that. All right. So I will say this. So for people out there listening, we did have Christopher Nolan on our show for Tenet back in 2020 with John David Washington. We also had Christopher Nolan on for Oppenheimer. If you never got a chance to see Tenet in theaters, it is back in IMAX. It was out during the pandemic, so there were a lot of people who didn't get a chance to see it in theaters. I highly recommend it. It's an incredible film. And as I said, don't try to understand it. Feel it. People try to understand every aspect of that movie. You don't need to. Just enjoy it.
Yeah. And then on your fifth IMAX rewatch, you'll understand.
Yes, I've seen it like 15 times.
Subtitles help.
That's Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago with the beautiful city of Chicago behind him. This is the reason why you should watch us on the YouTube channel. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
You had one job to do, Sean, and that was wear a maroon suit.
Yeah, I know. No one loops me in on the fashion conversation.
Hey, you don't have
beforehand
to be looped in. Just feel it.
Just feel it.
Exactly. Jake and I are Adam Levine took over. We're Maroon 2.
We're Maroon 2.
Yeah.
The cover is good.
Not quite. Not bad. I would like to know.
Shit, that's a better joke than my Spice World joke.
Our listeners are so good at doing this kind of thing. I'd like them to label which of us would be which Spice Girl.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
How many Spice Girls are there?
I think there's five. Four. Is there five?
Well, one's being left over.
Yeah, I couldn't name them if you asked me to.
The fifth Spice Girl is the audience at home.
Yeah. Well, I always love whenever we throw those challenges out there. We always get like the most interesting answers.
That's true.
Very true.
I'm probably Baby Spice. I don't really know. I have no idea. Dude, I was telling someone this today. It's so weird you brought up Spice World.
I want to see this transition.
You guys don't know this, but Kevin has a tattoo on his lower back that says Spice
Boy. He's been waiting for almost 300 episodes for someone to bring up Spice World.
Well, there's Baby Spice, Ginger Spice,
Sporty Posh Spice,
Sporty Spice,
Posh Spice. And
did you say Baby Spice?
Scary?
Yeah.
Scary Spice.
That's a really scary Spice. We did it, guys. It took us 299 episodes, but we got all five Spice Girls.
You can find us on social media at Sean_O'Connell.
I'm actually not joking. Earlier today, about an hour and a half ago, I was talking to someone in my newsroom because Jake and I both interviewed Mark Wahlberg yesterday for Arthur the King. And years ago, I don't remember the name of the hotel. I was in London for one of the Transformers films. And the hotel that the interviews were happening in was the same hotel where the Spice Girls shot their famous music video for whatever their big, I can't remember the name of the huge song they have.
But it was like their biggest.
I think it was. But whatever video it was a very big deal at the time. I'll never forget it. Mark Wahlberg was walking around the hotel. It was me and a bunch of other journalists. And then Mark Wahlberg allowed us to shoot a video on the same steps the Spice Girls shot the video, and he directed it and shot it. I remember seeing this video. I need to find a link. I'll send it to Gabe if I can find it, and we'll put it if he wants to in the YouTube thing here to click on it. But it was ridiculous. Yeah,
that's bizarre. Everything comes full circle.
Everything comes full circle to Spice World.
Yes.
Hello. If you're watching us on YouTube, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for sticking with us. We should say.
Hit subscribe. Turn on your notifications. Head to the comments. Let us know where you're listening from. Let us know your favorite Spice Girl. And share the show with a friend, a movie-loving friend. We are, as I mentioned last week, over 17,000 subscribers. Blows my mind.
That's pretty cool.
Approaching episode 300. I mean, we've grown this little baby since
our little show.
Awards Bund. I don't know if you guys know this, but we started as an awards podcast named Awards Bund.
Doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah, it doesn't sound familiar at all.
Go to youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. Of course, we're available all the different places where your podcast needs are met. You can also sign up for Real Blend Premium. It gets you an ad-free version of the show, a newsletter from me every other Friday. So check the description for information on where to sign up. Okay, so yes, I'm joking saying that we used to be an awards podcast, but we are very heavily into the Oscar race. We're going to be doing a lot of stuff for the Academy Awards as they approach. And we are thrilled to have Best Director nominee, Jonathan Glazer, who has made a number of incredible films, including the film that he is joining our show to talk about, The Zone of Interest.
And likely going to be, I know we're not doing Oscar prediction just yet, but this is going to win international feature. Like, he's going to win an Oscar on March 10th.
Is that, so it's Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall?
No, Anatomy of a Fall was not the country's chosen movie.
Oh,
talk about fumbling an Oscar.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's easily going to be Zone of Interest.
Okay, interesting.
In my opinion, I'm giving an early Oscar prediction, but those are coming soon, folks. Yeah, but I would predict that our guest today is about to have an Oscar in his hand on March 10th.
I don't say this lightly, but The Zone of Interest, which we're going to review on the other side of this interview, is one of the greatest films I have ever seen in my life. Like, I have never seen anything, and you'll see here in the interview, I'll never see it again, because it echoes in me for, I think, forever now, I'm imagining. I saw it 4.5 weeks ago, and I can't stop thinking about it. This is an extraordinary filmmaking movie in terms of the way this movie was made, but also the feeling that it gives you. It's horrifying and disturbing, but we'll dive into it in the interview and the review later. But I just wanted to say that up front, because if you have any, you know, if you're questioning whether or not you want to watch this film because of the subject matter, I do recommend seeing it. It's just a very tough watch, and Jonathan's going to explain that in the interview.
Well, then I will let him do that. And here's Jonathan Glazer joining the Real Blend Podcast on behalf of Zone of Interest.
Well, I'm going to jump into this, and I really kind of wanted to just sort of timestamp this moment, because it's pretty cool that we're getting the chance to chat with you the day after the BAFTAs, where the film won multiple well-deserved awards. And I know you don't make movies for award shows, but I am sort of curious what hearing your name, what hearing, you know, your incredible sound department, getting that sort of confirmation of your efforts, what does that mean to you, and how does it sort of affect your relationship with the movie, and what has today been like?
Thank you. It was certainly a surprise to get. You know, I'm always surprised that people are interested, to be frank. So it's always great when that translates into nominations, and even more unexpected, really, that we win some of them. It's obviously fantastic for the film. So my relationship with awards is about the fact that it encourages people to see the film, full stop. You know, that's the great thing about it. I have my own personal insecurities when it comes to moments like those, but you know, you just got to take a deep breath and get on with it. But the effect it has on the film is enormous. Yeah.
John, I was in LA about a month ago, and I had some time to kill during the day, and I was looking up theater showtimes, and Vista was playing a 35 millimeter engagement of your movie, and I actually still have my ticket from that day, because I bought two tickets, even though I was by myself, because I wanted to have one that I didn't tear, because I'd never been to that Vista before. And obviously, I know Quentin Tarantino owns that theater now. But since I saw that film, your movie has been echoing in my mind. It's been haunting me in a way that I can't even describe. I've never seen anything like it before. And for 4 weeks, I've been texting the guys saying, this movie has not left me. This movie is still echoing in my mind. I think about it constantly. So because your film did that to me, I want to know films that have done that to you, films that have echoed in your mind for a long period of time after seeing it, something that was just films that kind of that you think about like that.
Well, I mean, thank you. First of all, thank you for seeing it. And I'm pleased you got to see it there. Films, I mean, there's many films. I'm just going to go through the ones that occur to me as you said it, for different reasons. There's a Iranian film, a short 20-minute Iranian film called The House is Black, which is about which was made in the 1960s by a female Iranian poet who, and it's an absolutely remarkable film, possibly certainly one of my favorite films, or one of the films that I carry with me. And that was a story about, that was simply a leper. It's about a leper colony in the 1960s in Iran. It's made with such a extraordinary kind of clarity and fearlessness, a sort of an unflinching look that is so humanizing. You know, that's a fantastic film that stays with me. In the darker end of things, Salo, obviously the Pasolini film, which is you know, I've seen once and I never want to see again, but I've never stopped, you know, it's never been far from my mind. My goodness. Virgin Spring, Bergman, Lots of films, Mike. I don't know where to start. It's like, you know.
No, no worries. I'll just jump in real fast because there's something you said there in your answer that I think is interesting. Yeah. I was telling the guys this too, like, because you just said it and I wanted to say it to you. I don't know that I ever want to sit through the movie again, but it's one of the best films I've ever seen. So it's like, and I just wonder, do you take that as a compliment if someone says that? Because like, I don't need to see it again. I'm living it in my mind since I've seen it, you know?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, we all absorb films differently, don't we? And I think some people have seen the film multiple times because there are layers to it, which I hope will be clearer on second, third, fourth viewing. But the intention of the film is absolutely a visceral one. It's definitely a film which was made to elicit a kind of a physical response, almost that it gives you something. It gives you a feeling in your stomach that is almost like it's almost like. I'm going to put off anybody who wants to go to the cinema now, but it's almost like a stomach cramp. It's almost like if I eat that again, I will get that feeling. So therefore I won't eat it again. So in that sense, just physical point of view, I think it's a powerful experience.
I think serves as a perfect follow-up to that because I'm talking to you from Chicago. Kevin's talking to you from DC, and the film was in the Chicago International Film Festival just a couple of months ago. And so Christian, who is absolutely phenomenal in the film, was actually here in my studio with me for a sit down sort of long form conversation about the film. And one of the things he did tell me was that more than any character he's ever played, it took him, he said years for him to be able to sort of shake this experience and really kind of get past the places he had to go. But I am sort of curious, as sort of the man who crafted this story and who, you know, spent so much time putting it together. If, you know, we talk about the films haunting us, your actors talking about the films haunting them. Does it haunt you in the same way? Like whenever you're done with it and you've got, you know, final cut of the film and it's in theaters and it's doing its thing. Do you still feel like you've got to kind of work to detach yourself from it? Or are you too close in a way to have those kind of feelings toward it?
That's a good question. I am still processing it for myself. So because obviously I've been on a long journey with this from the beginning. And I've been thinking about little else. And so it's occupied so much of my time and my thoughts. That it's impossible to just sort of detach yourself from it and put it away. It is, it'll be with me forever, really. But I'm finding, I think when we get beyond the Oscars, which will be my last responsibility to this film, certainly in the short term, then I feel like I will be able to actually finally begin to actually process the experience of making it, the journey I've been on to make it. But yeah, I've lost a lot of sleep making it, and I think I would be worried if I didn't. You know, I'd feel like I've tried to take something on that I didn't take seriously enough, or something, or it didn't affect me enough. And if it wasn't going to affect me enough, I couldn't expect it to affect a viewer. You know, I had to do it to myself first. You know,
this is a stupid question, but just as a follow up, what does it mean for a filmmaker to process his own film? Like, I know what it means as a film fan to process someone else's work. I'm sort of curious what it means for you to process your film.
Well, I mean, for me to process a film, I mean, when I've finished a film, I don't ever look at it again. So I've never seen anything I've made after I've finished it.
You're missing out. They're really great.
Thank you. But I find it really difficult to look back. You know, I don't want to look back. I want to keep sort of looking forward. I'm sure most filmmakers would agree with that. But it's you process it in different ways. It's not this particular film, I think, is going to take a lot longer for obvious reasons, the subject matter and the atmosphere of the film. But I think it's about, for me, it's about almost having this period of time between finishing something and starting something else. Like, I'm very much like that. I don't overlap my projects. I commit fully to something for as long as it takes to achieve it. And then once it's achieved, there's this beautiful sweet spot of almost like peace, of like the thing I've made is no longer asking anything of me. And the next thing I might make hasn't yet tapped on my shoulder and said, you know, that will be the next thing I venture into. So it's a sort of fallow period, and I love it. It's like You know, I can read a book and fall asleep. I can take my wife out for dinner. You know, I can go and see some friends, go to a football game that I wasn't able to go to. And, you know, just do things like that, just life stuff without this kind of the burden of this in this sort of artistic investigation that's always on me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So processing for me is a period of, I need that space between two things, really.
Sure.
You know, John, we as Jake said, we created this show because we want to educate our audience on how films are made. And I think this is one of the greatest films I've personally ever seen, just from purely from a filmmaking standpoint, what it's done for me as an audience member, the immersion level. As I mentioned, I saw it at the Vista, so that sound design was absolutely incredible to kind of hear it in that theater. But you have a quote that you've said in a couple of the featurettes, which is you wanted to create a present tense as an experience. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's such a brilliant way to approach this, because it's not like we're going back in time. We're supposed to be there in that moment. And the utilizing of the cameras and hiding the cameras in the house, or having some visible and some hidden. I'm just curious if you can just walk our audience through that process. I mean, for people who haven't seen the behind the scenes footage, you're like sitting in an area and looking at all the cameras and all the visuals that you have. Can you just explain that process of placing cameras and kind of creating that present tense?
Certainly. I mean, the idea of the present tense was because I didn't want to make it like it was something which was 80 years ago and we could all feel safely removed from. Mm. So I wanted everything to be shot as if, you know, we were looking at it through a 21st century lens, really. Or with it, in fact, we were looking at everything through a 21st century lens. So I absolutely embraced the most modern, sharpest technology that would be part of the technology I would need to service that idea. How we achieved part of it was by setting up a system involving 10 cameras. Those 10 cameras would be positioned in different rooms depending on which action we were going to film that day. Obviously, I would be blocking the action with the actors and then setting the cameras or refining those camera positions once I was happy with how we were going to block it. And then we'd film it. Now, filming it involved, there was no people operating a camera. So there was no paraphernalia that you would normally see on a film set. Everything the actors looked at was 1943 in all four directions, north, south, east, west. They would believe everything they were looking at. So they're not on a film set. They are in that space, in that world. And what that means is that the people who are looking after those cameras, the focus pullers, who are making sure that characters are in focus as they move in and out of rooms and so on, up and downstairs, all those cameras are wired through holes in the floor into the basement. And then there's, you know, five, six focus pullers in the basement all day long waiting for that stuff to go on. And then that's their function. And the house is sort of umbilically linked using all of the wiring that came up through the chimney, essentially, and all the way over the prison wall to a shipping container behind the wall. And in that shipping container, I was in there with Lucas Arl, the cinematographer, Chris Oddie, the production designer, the DIT people who were recording all that information and so on, sound people, my translator. So it was like an OB, it was like an outside broadcast. It was like an event. It was like you're shooting an event rather than a movie. And the effect is that the actors are completely and utterly naturalistic because they're not looking or playing into any one or other lens. They don't know what's filming them. And the effect gives the audience, I think, the opportunity to almost project themselves onto those characters. Mm-hmm. You sort of see, it's almost like, you know, we're in those rooms and we're hidden away watching from a corner, you know, fly on the wall. And we can just observe. And it's in our observation, I think, that we begin to sort of analyze them. You know?
Real quick follow-up, because I could have this wrong. And one of the featurettes that I saw used German lenses, Leica lenses. And I find that interesting as well, because also, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's a 1:7:8 aspect ratio. I think I had that right. So I was just curious about, if you could, ratio choice and lens choices and how you narratively decide on that and how they play into your narrative.
Well, the ratio is 16:9, which I think is the same as 1:7:7, but it's a it's basically a sort of neutral frame. So it's almost a neutral frame. I didn't want anything which was cinematic in the sense of, you know, for all the reasons I was avoiding all the kind of tropes and conventions of cinema. I wanted a neutral canvas kind of thing. So 16:9 is a very good format for that, to achieve that, or at least as a starting point. So what's the second part of your question? Sorry.
Well, just the idea of your lens choice and then the aspect ratio and how those play into your narrative decisions.
Right. Sorry. So the cameras are extremely small cameras, and they were able, they're not big bulky cameras that the actors have to push past and maneuver past, because so they're extremely small cameras. Like I said, not operated. So they're kind of either attached to the wall on brackets or stands, or hidden away in a cupboard or whatever. And the lenses that we used were Leica lenses, and they're extremely sharp lenses. Everything, all the choices really were to serve this idea of now. It was happening. We were witnessing something as it was happening. Mm. So there was no, excuse me, there was no, I didn't want any kind of aesthetic barrier or sort of affectation to that. I just wanted it to be as absolutely like you were looking at it with 20/20 vision, unflinching. Mm. You know? So really you're just looking for the right tools to achieve that sensation.
Wow. John, I mean this with the utmost respect, because I know that you are obviously nominated for Best Director, but I think the Oscar win I am cheering for and hoping for the most is your sound team. Because that, I mean, the sound on this film is unlike anything I've ever experienced in a theater. And I'm sure Kevin would say the same. I'm sort of curious, at what point in your process did you realize how important sound was going to be? Like, did you know when you put pen to paper, sound is going to be huge here? Or was it on the set, or was it in post when sound really became so crucial in this film?
Well, you get to those decisions sort of step by step. They don't all happen, of course, at once. And the first step was to kind of understand that I wanted to not reenact the violence. And so I committed all of the scenes I wrote were going on the perpetrator side of the wall, as opposed to on the prison camp side of the wall. The death camp side of the wall. So, and once I made that decision, then of course I knew that the sounds that were going to be emanating from that side of the wall would sort of bear down on everything we see.
Yeah.
So I would say early in the process, mm-hmm. Long before post-production, and before the shoot as well, long before the shoot. And then there was just a series with Johnny Byrne and his sound team of, you know, gathering all these sounds based on sort of field recordings, using field recordings. There aren't people going into booths and reenacting things. It's really about gathering real world sounds, either that exist or that one needs to go and record with hidden microphones. So let's say you're looking for German voices shouting because you wanted to hear the sound, the idea of guards, you know, and you could hear them on the wind, you know, thinking from over the wall. You know, I suppose conventionally what you'd do is you'd get a German sounding guy and you'd put him in a microphone in a booth and you'd get him to shout, and then you'd deal with the level of sound in the mix. That would never satisfy me. I mean, I wouldn't want to start with that kind of fakery. So then you think, well, how do I get German people to shout without me asking them to? And then you think, okay, well, they play football on a Sunday afternoon, like anywhere in Europe, and there's 22 guys, you know, two teams of 11 guys shouting at each other and as they're kicking a ball around, and you go there with microphones and you sit on the sideline and with microphones and you record it. And then you have a repository of, if you like, German shouts, you know? So that would be one layer of what you need to work with. And there in one layer of hundreds. Wow. So it's just very resourceful use of real-world sound, really.
That's wild.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, is because you create an atmosphere with the sound in a way that is, like, it's so fascinating because you never really understand truly what you're hearing, but you understand it in a way. It kind of reminded me of what Fincher did with Seven, where he never shows you the violence, and you just learn about it through the dialogue. And it's that much more horrifying when you don't see it, because you what you're imagining is way more horrifying than what you could show us, I would argue. And so I wanted to ask you about the mixture of score and sound design, because your score and your sound design almost are married in a beautiful way that you almost can't differentiate at times because you're so immersed in it. And I just wanted to know if you is that blend part of your narrative storytelling? Do you want us to not be able to differentiate between the atmosphere of the music and the surroundings?
Sometimes I think the blur of those tools that one uses are you know, is more interesting to sound is a very is interpretive, you know, in a way that pictures aren't. You know, when we see a picture, we know what it is, but, you know, instantly. But when we hear a sound, we can interpret that sound in many different ways. And of course, right, we tune so much stuff out. You guys look like you're both in pretty quiet offices, but you know, if there's a fire, if a fire engine was to go past, you'd hear it, but you wouldn't really think, oh, there's a fire engine. You just accept it. So it's a layering up of all of those real world sounds that are going on. You know, it's by no means a straightforward intentionally vague, so that you may not vague, but is that a baby crying or is that a prisoner screaming? You know, is that a train or is that a, what am I listening to here? What is that? Is that an industrial sound? What is that?
And all of we lean in more. We lean into the screen more when you do that.
Precisely. And I think we bring to the, you know, I think a lot of filmmakers underestimate what we bring to the audience, to what we bring to the movies ourselves. The images we carry in us in our minds of, for instance, in this subject of the Holocaust, those sounds, you have the images in your head. You know what those images, you know what's going on behind that wall. And what you don't know or haven't seen, you can only imagine. So those are always going to be much more powerful than anything that I could or anyone, I believe, would be able to achieve by filming it. What you're showing here through sound is the abyss, and that cannot be filmed. If it's filmed, then it's not the abyss. It's a it's kind of cosplay version of it. It's it's never going to get to the depth that it needs to in order to affect you physically the way I hope it does for people.
Yeah.
Perfectly leads into my next question, because in terms of visuals, there's so many things in this film that are so subtle. For everything that you show us, there are 10 things that you don't. They're still in our mind that we can still visualize, but you never take the camera there. I'm sort of curious, as a storyteller, how did you decide I'm going to show A, but I'm not going to show B through Z? Like, what was the difference between what you did want us to see and what you didn't want us to see?
Do you have an example, a particular example that springs to mind?
Just in terms of, we see the smoke pillowing on the other side of the wall. And just that image itself springs to mind, to your point, 10,000 other images that we've seen in history books and documentaries and other films. And I love that you show that, but we don't really go that much further on the other side of the world just because it doesn't really feel like we need to. And I'm just sort of curious, was there ever a moment where you almost went any further than you ever did?
There were certainly moments in the scripting where I thought I was going to go over the other side, you know, and I think, but I realized just through, you know, process for me is always a process of sort of distillation. You're distilling something down. I start with a maximum and try and get to the minimum. And really, you can get to the minimum once you understand what your ingredients are and what they will achieve. So for instance, in this context with the chimney that was, I can't remember how many meters away. It was I can't even remember. I don't want to put a figure on it, but it was the chimney of Crematorium One, which is the one you see at the end of their garden, on the other side of their garden, is a direct simulation in distance to the house as the real chimney to the real house. So it was so close to their lives. It was so obvious what it was. I wanted to just simply show that. And I think when you see that, and when you hear the sounds of people in that who are being led into gas chambers, you hear it, well, he's outside having a cigar one evening, you know, nice stroll in his garden after a, you know, birthday cake with his family. Anyone might go out. Well, you have family, you have dinner with your family. It's a lovely spring evening and summer evening. You're going to pop outside and play with the dog or whatever you're going to do. It's just that. So I think it's the, we know what that horror is. We know what that smoke is. I realized I didn't need to get any closer than we do. I didn't believe I needed to get any closer. I thought that everything could be achieved from the distance we were witnessing it from.
You stay subjective. It's important.
Yeah.
I agree with you 100%. I would like to follow up on something you said. You said initially in the scripting that you did go on the, were there specific scenes that you wrote and then cut? Were there scenes that featured, more of the other side?
Because we stay on the house with the house, we stay within the house and garden for the majority of the film. I'm sort of committing by deciding that I'm only ever going to see him when he comes home, mm-hmm. From work, you know? So it's like a Douglas Sirk movie or something, you know, set in some American suburb, mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. So he comes home from work and he hangs his hat up and he has dinner with his kids and chats with his wife and, you know, whatever, listens to the radio, reads a book, goes to bed. That's what he does. That's what we're watching. So it's not very much like there aren't opportunities to see the other side of the wall, put it like that. I've committed to staying on this side of the wall, so I can only ever see him coming back from it. So I did have scenes before I'd made the decision that I simply couldn't cross that line. That line became, a very important barometer of. It's almost like you're making a film. You're sort of making a moral decision, really, about what you can and can't show. And so, you know, those things just fell by the wayside. Once I realized I didn't. It's inevitable that when you first start writing, you think of all of it. You know, you're all over the shop with it, and bit by bit, like I said, through distilling, you end up really understanding what it is you're making, and then getting rid of that stuff is easy.
Fascinating.
You know, John, one thing I had a pretty profound moment. I remember watching the film, walking out, and then thinking that I just watched an R-rated movie. And I remember looking at the thing going, wait, that was PG-13.
I gotta be honest. I did not know that. Is it really?
It blew my mind when I read that, because when you think about it, it makes sense. There's no really truly visible brutality or violence. It's really all in your what you hear and see. I was just curious though, because I remember, Jake, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't The Conjuring rated R because it was almost like so
scary?
Just because
it was scary. Yeah. There's no sex or violence or language. It's just because of how scary it is.
Wow. So I wanted to ask you, was there any at all issue with the MPA and kind of like getting a PG-13 rating? Because what I experienced felt like an R-rated movie, if that makes sense. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
I agree. I remember being quite shocked myself when I saw the rating of the film. I was just thinking, really? Is that, how's that? Okay. I don't know. Maybe people will take, maybe kids will go and see this film. I think I'm surprised by it. Like you were. because it has a psychological effect I'm not going to argue with the rating.
They change it tomorrow. You're like, what just happened? All right, I'll get you out of here on this last question, because there's a quote that I keep seeing like kind of in the featurettes as well, which is that the film is a reflection of ourselves in a way, and kind of in terms of modern times, and you know when you're watching this film, you do think about how we think about the world. I mean, obviously this is a very specific situation, but it does have a lot of timely elements that we can compare it to. And I was just curious what reflection on your own self you found. I know to Jake's question about the idea of a film, your own film haunting you, but I'm actually more curious about the reflection you found, how it's changed your own perception of the world, how you walk through life differently now. What reflection did you find in yourself?
Well, I think, somebody said a little while ago to me, it makes you wonder, like, what's over my wall, you know, which I thought was a very interesting way of looking at it, in a very particular way that's also a very universal way. And so I think, it's, as we know, the comforts that we enjoy in the safety and security of the societies we live in do not come without a cost to others. And it's looking at that, really, I think. And so I look at it myself. Of course, I'm mindful of it in the sense that it led me to make a film about it. So I'm conscious of the forever conscious of the gross kind of inequality of resource and in the world and the fact that people are killing each other for them, for those resources and everything that stems from it. It's so abominable. It just feels to me that to try and make something from a particular individual point of view, that those are the things that can foster change. I think, I don't mean I'm going to change anything with the film, but I hope it's part of the dialogue of change, which is really to be able to self-examine, really to be able to look at ourselves and be honest with ourselves about what we choose to empathize with and what we choose not to, which human beings are more important to us than others and for why. So it's sort of, there's all those questions in it, I think, but people, like I said, I hope people come at it from a physical, their experience is a physical first feeling, they don't need to be history majors to get anything out of this film, far from it. I think it's a human film before it's anything else.
Well, John, I just want to say thank you for joining our show. This has been a profound honor to have you on. Ever since seeing your film, I've been telling every single person I've known to watch it. It is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking, and I've never seen anything like this in the years that I've been watching cinema. Thank you for joining our show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Jay. I appreciate it, too.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you.
Have a great day.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We want to thank our good friends at A24 and also Jonathan Glazer for joining us for this show. Gabe, can you look up real fast the sure. best director nominees and who we managed to get this year?
Yeah, yeah. Give me just a moment.
I can tell you right now.
I think we came really close.
Just came close to for a Anatomy tweet. Of Fall. We had...
Here, I've got it right here.
We haven't had Justine, though, on the show, have we?
I don't think Justine was got a...
Justine got a screenplay. Sorry.
Yeah. No, Anatomy of Fall. Okay, here we go. I got you, boys. I looked it up as yes. Justine for Anatomy of a Fall. Scorsese for Killers of the Flower Moon. Nolan for Oppenheimer. Poor Things, or Yorgos for Poor Things, and Glazer for Zone of Interest. So three of the five. Martin Scorsese, ever elusive.
yes.
And forever I think we, on the Anatomy of a list. Fall is the kind of movie that maybe we'd have an opportunity to come back around. It's one I think that
they just did a small press day that I think Kevin and I did last week. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of, but they've probably been doing press since the Cannes
exactly.
Festival last year.
Yeah.
But
I found this really interesting though, because for all the talk about Greta Gerwig getting in, not getting in, when people are talking about the nominations as they came out, one of the names that everybody kind of circled as saying like, oh no, they're in, it was Glazer. It was Jonathan Glazer. And it was for the power and the impact of this film. And also his, I mean, he's a respected filmmaker. Mm-hmm. His film's previous birth, Sexy Beast. Oh, I think Sexy Beast. After Into the Skin, you know, Under the Skin, put him on a ton of people's radars.
Which I was not a fan of. That's really the only movie he's done.
I loved that movie. Loved it. Anyway, Jakey, what was your takeaway? I mean, I think we all know that this is a really difficult film to sit through, but what's your takeaway on the film and having spoken to Jonathan about it?
One, I was very grateful to have this conversation. We talk a lot about, you know, when we often complain about the 4-minute junket circuit of which we're all a part of, and the main, one of the main reasons we created the show being to sort of break that concept and have these in-depth conversations. This is exactly the type of movie that I think is perfectly exemplifies why we created the show in the first place, in that we often talk about, how did people do a junket for Schindler's List? Now, granted, when they did junkets back in 93, 30 plus years ago, they got more time than we do today. But the concept of squeezing in a quick conversation about something like Schindler's List seems impossible. And the same concept goes here for Zone of Interest, this idea of trying to have a quick conversation about this topic is just impossible. So I was very grateful to sort of have the in-depth conversation that we had. That being said, I mean, look, it's a remarkable film that, and I think Kevin and I will both say this, that we'll never see again. I will never watch this movie. You know, it's the Holocaust, World War II. It's a topic that has been approached in so many different ways and so many different angles by different filmmakers. World War II just in general, but specifically when it comes to the Holocaust. I felt like I'd never really seen a Holocaust movie like this before, in that it almost is a better example of the evil that surrounded the Holocaust by not showing you the evil, by showing you people's capability of going about their everyday life, that things could be almost, you know, this isn't meant to be like a disrespectful comparison, but like the fact that these people, this you know, Nazi commander and his family were able to live what sort of feels like a Leave It to Beaver style existence, you know, in a quaint little house where mom and the kids wait for dad to come home at the end of the day, except dad was, you know, a commandant at a concentration camp at Auschwitz. And to me, that almost is hard. That's impossible for me to wrap my brain around. You know, right. And there are so many subtleties in the movie that hit you like a sledgehammer once you, you know, because there will be moments where it's telling you something. And at least for me, it may have taken me like 15 to 20 seconds to go, oh, shit, that's what, you know, there's a moment where Sandra Hüller, the great Sandra Hüller, who is also in Anatomy of a Fall, she plays the commander's wife. And there are moments where she's trying on jackets and coats at the beginning of the film. And about 20 seconds into this shot, you realize, oh, those were clothes taken from the Jewish men and women and children who were taken into these concentrations. And she's trying them on like she's at Macy's. And just the subtleties of those moments where it doesn't beat you over the head with what it's trying to say. It gives you a moment to sort of play catch up and realize what's happening here. And I feel like that sort of moment is a microcosm example of why this movie works. It's incredibly subtle. There's so much more. I mean, Kevin blew my mind in the interview by pointing out that the film is PG-13. Because if you had asked me, I would have said, no, this is a hard R. But then Kevin brilliantly said, but okay, but what is it that you actually see? And you're right. You don't really see. I mean, you see a pillowing of smoke on the other side, coming from the other side of a wall. But because of your knowledge of history and because of your knowledge of what happened on the other side of that wall, your imagination starts running laps, and everything that you imagine is far more horrible than anything that's ever been on the screen. And to me, that's just the brilliance of what Glazer does here, and an example of why I think he very much earned one of the 5 best director slots, because he uses, 3 words to tell a novel's worth of story. You know, the Holocaust has never really kind of been told from this perspective before. And look, at the end of the day, you know, this is a topic that the more education you can get out there, the better, the more people know about this from every possible angle. But, you know, in terms of a cinematic representation of evil, the fact that, you know, this family was able to live just a quaint sense of repetition over and over again on with a shared wall of a concentration camp is one of the most shocking examples of evil I think I've ever seen on the big screen before. So we'll never see it again. Respect it beyond measure. Beyond honored to have had Glazer on the show. But man, what a watch!
I think, and to what Jake talks about, I think what's so horrifying about the film is it's so shocking that you can't comprehend it. Mm-hmm. Like it's completely incomprehensible in the sense of how, like, the subtlety and the nuance of how we're living in this house with this family, and a husband and wife are having an argument about a husband having to work too much and having to travel for work. And by travel, he means going to other concentration camps. So you're sitting in the middle of a husband and wife arguing that you would see, like Jake's talking about, in any other type of genre where, like, husbands and wives argue, but the argument is surrounding the most horrifying topic you can think of. Like, it is so, I mean, there's obviously so many other horrifying things in the world, but this particular aspect of things, that's what's so shocking to me, is is the right word to use here, Jake, compliance, like the family, the kids, sure, and like everybody just kind of, it was as if they thought that this was the way the world should be. And we are just living in their home as they just continue living this life with this mindset. And he's doing this job, which is killing millions of people. And it is, I don't know, on a personal note, my mom's Jewish. My entire side of my mom's family is Jewish. And when I was a kid, I remember they took me to the Holocaust Museum, and I can still see for some reason, it's an outer body memory for me. When I walked down the halls in have you guys been before with, mm-hmm. With
in
the
DC?
Shoes? Yeah, the shoes. Yeah, all right. So there's an area where there's all these shoes from the Holocaust behind glass. And it's just, it feels like thousands of shoes of people who died. And it's just, I'll never forget as a kid seeing that. And it was part of the reason why I waited till I was 38 to watch Schindler's List. I have going to the Holocaust Museum as a kid was one of the most horrifying experiences I've ever had. Because when you see it for real, like, and you see these shoes in person, or you're hearing these stories, it's beyond comprehension. But as Jake said, World War II and the Holocaust has been covered many times in cinema over the years. And and it's something that we seem to understand through cinema. And then even though it will never be understood, but when you watch a film like this, it brings such a unique perspective to it that it, like Jonathan says in the interview, it gives you a stomach ache. It makes you feel, it turns your stomach in a way that, like, we can't imagine the horrors that were happening on the other side of that wall. And Jake, we talk about sound design. This is one of the big talkers for this movie, and it should be. The sound design in this film, Jonathan has talked about this, like, there's two movies happening. There's the visual film, and then there's the sound film. And Jake, I brought this up in the interview as well, and I think Jonathan responded to it. Like, and again, the comparison was not at all in the sense of, like, I'm not saying, like, these movies are like this. But the idea of, like, Fincher withholding the violence in Seven, and then we learn about it through dialogue, or like for Oppenheimer, for example, when we don't go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we just look at Killian's face and how he's processing it. The reason I use those comparisons is because it's what you don't see that is so much more horrifying. What we imagine is way worse than what could ever be filmed. And that's what I believe Jonathan was going for here, because by not entering the Auschwitz camp and just hearing the sounds and the visuals of the smoke and the screams and the gunshots and the horrifying things you're hearing while this family is having a normal, quote unquote, normal being of existence somehow. Like, You have a father reading his daughter nighttime stories. Out her window is the fire and the smoke from Auschwitz and the screaming. And it's as if there's nothing going on. It doesn't. It's so disturbing. I can't explain it. Yeah.
Let me ask a question. I haven't seen it yet. I need to press play on it before the Oscars. I plan to. It's the difficult subject matter. But Jakey, let me go to you on this one. How come he's included in the best director conversation? What is it about the, is it the restraint, do you think?
Do you mind if I step in for this real quick?
Sure.
Do you know how he'd shot it, Sean?
No.
Okay, so I think at any given time there was 10 cameras rolling. And the house, and this has been talked about in the interview a bit, but in the house, they set up cameras all over the house. Some of them were visible to the actors, some of them were not. And Jonathan Glazer, I'm going to quote him on this. He used the term Big Brother. And what he meant by that is the filmmakers are outside the house, like in a tent of some sort, watching all the monitors of all the 10 cameras or so they have set up. I don't believe there was anybody in the house except for the actors. And so you had the rig. So everything was done almost docu-style. And the way that Jonathan talks about it is he wanted to create present tense in the past. So you're not watching something from the past. You're being dropped into the moment. So everything's filmed. They say this in the featurette, they use German lenses, Leica lenses. And these are not super glamorizing lenses. And Jonathan talks about this a lot as well. And because I've watched a lot of him discussing this stuff, cinema generally glamorizes things. When you shoot a story or you make a movie, there's a certain level of glamour that comes with cinematic glamour in terms of all storytelling and film. And he wanted to get away from that. It's probably, I think the term bleak is a great term to use for a film like this, Jake, I would argue, because it's just, it's so subtle and nuanced. And so to answer your question about why he deserves a Best Director nomination, everything we just said about the sound design and the approach to shooting this film. And I said this to Jonathan Glazer, I'm 5 weeks into seeing this film and I still wake up thinking about it. And that's not an exaggeration. I'm not trying to sound like, I'm over the top. I've never seen anything like this before. And I cannot believe it's just shocking. It almost makes me want to cry. I cannot explain to you how horrifying this film is.
Okay.
But it's necessary. And I want to make that point. That's very important to me. Like everything we're saying, it might sound like, don't go see this. No, you need this perspective because it's not only the past we're looking at here, but it's also we're looking, as he says, at ourselves in modern day and what we decide to walk past and not think about or not do anything about. Jake, real quick though, just don't you think you deserve Best Director?
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, it's so funny is, especially in journalism, so often this idea of, you gotta get both sides of the story, every story you gotta, and it's just still like, well, not all stories, because guess what? The other side of the Holocaust perspective, they're still wrong. There is no other side. This is the other side. This is literally the other side of the wall. And guess what? It's just as bad and evil, if not more so. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, that kind of, Glazer's ability to bring a new viewpoint and a new perspective into a moment in history that, we need to know and do know very well. And the way he's able to tell it in a way that I've never really seen it told before. To me, it's the very definition of, why a person earns a Best Director nomination.
The Zone of Interest is in theaters as we speak, and it is contending for multiple Oscars. And we want to thank again Jonathan Glazer for coming on the show to discuss his film. Let's take a quick break, and we'll reconvene on the other side. And we are back. All right. So there's a news item that we want to touch on because Gareth Edwards is a friend of the show. We are fans in general of the Jurassic Park franchise. And I'm going to go to Jakey on this one because...
A loose general, Jake. A loose general.
Jake loves the Jurassic Park films. Not so much the Jurassic World of the Jurassic films. Park films. And now we're hearing that they're going to continue Jurassic World. And Gareth Edwards is coming on board. It has a release date, quote unquote, of July 2nd, 2025. I'm not quite sure how that's going to happen. And we're excited because David Koepp is writing it. Jake, on a scale of 1 to 10, where does this new news put you in terms of your excitement about the revival of the Jurassic franchise?
It makes no logical sense. I'm like Charlie Brown with a football. Like, I just keep getting fooled over and over again because I have not liked a Jurassic movie since Steven Spielberg directed them. Jurassic Park is one of my all-time favorite movies. I love The Lost World. I think it is an incredible sequel. There are some great moments in that. And at that point is when I stopped liking them. I don't like Jurassic Park 3, and I don't like any of the Jurassic Worlds. I thought they all sucked.
Jurassic World is good.
No, it's not. It's not good. It is not a good movie.
It's very fun.
It is. But I... That being said, every time they announce new Jurassic news, I'm like, okay, I'm in, you know? I don't like the idea of a rushed Jurassic movie. That concerns me. David Koepp coming back to write is always a step in the right direction. And obviously, Gareth Edwards, you know, we've seen what he can do with Rogue One, obviously the creator. You know, the way he handled and utilized special effects and the creator, and in Rogue One as well, gives me a lot of hope. One of the things I remember loving about Rogue One is his making it feel like an original Star Wars. You know, that was always sort of my issue with Ridley Scott's Alien prequels, is that all the technology that they had in their ships looked better than the technology that the characters had in the years to come in the, you know, in the original Alien film. I like that he matched. I'm hoping that he sort of gives us a match for that original film. But I gotta be honest with you, that Jurassic Park video game that's coming out is the most excited, and I think the best idea for a Jurassic anything since The Lost World.
It puts you on the island during the first movie?
It takes place the day after Jurassic Park, and the idea is that everyone's been evacuated except for one person from the company got left behind accidentally. Okay. So, you know, and I don't know if you saw the trailer.
It seems like it's going to be like a survival
Yeah, it's a survival thing. At one point, you know, she runs by the Tyrannosaurus.
Is that person Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Oh, it should be. But it's like little things. It's like, you know, the Velociraptor is still in the freezer from the kitchen. You know, she runs by the Tyrannosaurus paddock and you know, Alan Grant's hat is still on the ground from being blown off by the T-Rex. Like all those.
Jake, are there people still holding onto their butts on the island as well?
That's the secret in Jurassic, Kevin. You always hold on to your butts.
If you stop, you lose an arm.
Yeah, exactly right.
Keep your hands on your butt.
You know, this series and franchise hasn't given me a reason to have hope in 25 years. Until I see something that convinces me otherwise, I don't know.
Couple other facts about this. David Leitch and Kelly McCormick are still producing after talks with David Leitch to direct fell through. There is a new storyline, though no indication if any previous cast members will be joining. All of this is via Variety, which had the story. I'm done with the original cast members participating. I don't need that.
I mean, we saw what happened last. I mean, it added nothing.
No.
It was bugs. It was a movie about freaking bugs.
Would you go in a different direction.
Jake, if they just did this video game, would you want them to just be like on a helicopter leaving at the very beginning of the movie? Like, would you just want even
that? That's what it should be. Yeah. That's actually really funny if the opening graphic is the helicopter leaving and this one woman is waving. wait, I'm still here kind of thing. So
I'm starting to feel like Jurassic, like I'm feeling about the Ghostbusters franchise. They just,
I like the last Ghostbusters movie.
I think Ghostbusters is going in a good direction. This new one looks like it's less establishing the Ghostbusters, which they had to do for a new generation, and more telling stories with Ghostbusters involved.
Right.
I didn't like the forcing of the original cast.
Yeah.
Like I had a problem with the way the Harold Ramis thing was handled. I didn't like
that. Oh, that was terrible.
Oh, interesting. I actually kind of liked it.
It just felt a little, I don't know. As beautiful as that moment seems on paper, I don't think it worked in the movie. I guess the reason I'm comparing these two is because they're both long running franchises. They're both franchises that have brought back OG characters, and I don't think have done, in my personal opinion, done well with those OG characters in the return, especially in the, I actually liked Paul Feig's film. I just didn't think the OG characters needed to be in that movie. What's interesting to me about this Jurassic thing. Well, I said you guys, and listen, Ghostbusters is one of my favorite movies of all time. I mean, this is, you know, I have a very nostalgic feeling about those first two movies that Ivan Reitman did. But also, I got to say, one of the proudest things that I've ever had been a part of on this show was when we were able to have Jason and Ivan.
Oh my God. I forgot about that. What a flashback.
If you go back and watch this, it's so cool because you have father and son. Obviously, Ivan passed.
And we're talking about Ghostbusters.
We often talk about, like, you know, sometimes getting them for a different movie and having to shoehorn in the questions we really want to ask. We got him for a Ghostbusters movie.
And Jason talking about, like, growing up on set like that. Like, it was just kind of
you want to go back and listen to that episode.
Dude, hearing them talk about how they shot the egg thing practically when the egg starts frying on the counter. Like, that was one of my favorite interviews we ever did on our show, because if you go back, I was showing it to someone the other day because we were putting together a promo for this Ghostbusters thing we're trying to do because the new one's coming out and there's a Ghostbusters club that it's whatever, it's minutia. But I was showing my buddy the interview we did with Ivan and Jason. I'm like, wow, I forgot that we had both of them. It wasn't even the father son thing, because didn't Ivan Reitman end up passing like months later, or was it like shortly after? Very shortly after. And I remember, like, that was such a special thing to have, and they were sitting right next to each other. You had this generation of a father who passed his movie down to his son. Anyways, the point I'm making is, like, with Jurassic, I don't love the way the new ones have been handled, but yesterday when we were texting, I said, now you have my attention. Because Gareth makes me excited to see it. Because I think that Gareth's going to bring, like, what we saw with the creator, what we saw with Rogue One. Rogue One, actually, I'm sorry if you already made this point, but Rogue One was handled beautifully, right, by Gareth. And that was a continuation or part of this larger Star Wars world. And I think there's been, you know, we've been getting a little fatigued by it, but he brought a special, interesting look to it that I thought was fascinating. The end of that movie is remarkable.
Some will argue that a lot of that movie is Tony Gilroy, though.
Sure. I understand.
Yeah, but I felt a lot of Rogue One in Creator. I feel like he proved to me that his fingerprints are on Rogue One what I saw in the Creator.
But then here's the secret to this Jurassic movie. Give him $60 million.
Yes. Low budget.
Give him $60 million and have him do a Jurassic movie. I don't want a $250 million Jurassic movie.
I agree with you. And go back to that middle ground. I know that Bayona? Bayona, who did Fallen Kingdom, and Colin. I know that there was a lot of talk about the animatronics and practical effects of the new ones. But what makes the original Jurassic Park so brilliant is the marriage of CG and practical. And based on the limitations of CG back then, necessity is the mother of invention. You know, the T-Rex running shot works because you start with the practical thousands of pounds animatronic T-Rex, and then you cut to the CG running. Because it's raining and because it's dark, you've already set that in place in your mind.
It's wishful thinking, though, because it's still a giant studio that's going to have to make the call about where the budget goes.
Sure.
So maybe. But $60 million thing, then maybe if they can get it in there. I want to say, though, a tease for something to come in the coming weeks. Mentioning Tony Gilroy, excellent. Andor is great. And clearly, you see Rogue One in Andor clearly. But coming up, we have the cinematographer of Rogue One at some point will be on the show and told us that the best scene in Rogue One was Gareth Edwards deciding to change that scene to the to what it was. I'll just say that. So true. I mean,
fair enough.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah.
That's a good tease.
I'll say one more quick thing just about, like, because I think Sean has a brilliant point here, because what do you have to lose? Go low. I mean, the higher budget ones, I know they made a lot of money, but they weren't well received.
I think we need more information before. I mean, right now we love the idea of a tight movie on a tight budget. Yes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that he can't take $100 million and turn it into a great movie. Like, I think he's done enough on every scale to show that he understands how to use his budget. And I think that's all I need.
It's not just him, though. Like, if you take a look at box offices, like, movies are not making what they used to make.
Sure.
Like, I was looking at box office this past weekend and looking at films that get to like 70, 80, you know, now if you can get over 100, it's kind of a win.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
The scale is going to have to balance where the studios are spending less
yeah.
to make profit.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to make $1 billion to break. Look, like I know, the Mission Impossible budget was inflated because of all the COVID shutdowns. But like,
sure.
the fact that that movie made $650, almost $700 million and was deemed a financial disappointment is right. unbelievable to me. Like, like $700 million should be great.
It's a crazy business movie. Strategy.
Too. Yeah. So this idea of these $350 million movies needing to make $1 billion to even start being in the conversation of whether or not it was successful. It's not, you know, like it's, I mean, we were in a bubble where, you know, yeah, we had that 1 year where Disney had like 8 or 9 movies cross the $1 billion mark. And
right.
for some reason, Hollywood thought that's life from here on out, instead of looking yeah. at it like the anomaly that it was.
Right.
They took exactly. it as the rule. And it's not like we're now at a point where like, last year, we had $3 billion. Like we had Barbie, almost Oppenheimer and Mario. So what, $2 billion movie? Like, that's probably going to be life moving forward.
There's no reason why Oppenheimer should cost $100 million and Jurassic should cost $250 million to $300 million in terms of budget. I think, like, these budgets are so inflated. So I'm watching a lot of Masterclass right now. Have you guys ever seen the Masterclass?
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen so far? Sorry.
So I just finished James Cameron. Have you watched Cameron?
I haven't seen that one. I recommend Ron Howard's one of the.
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Have you seen it?
I know that's one of the ones I want
to
watch.
He's one of the original guys. You should queue that up
soon. It's one of the most just enlightening discussions on filmmaking, right. and he does, I think, a really great job of structuring that.
Where are these for people who want to find them?
It's an app, like it's called Masterclass, and mm-hmm. you pay like a yearly subscription. What I do, which I think is kind of cool, you can put it on your Apple TV. So nice. I sit in my apartment and I get a notepad out and I watch. And the reason I bring it up is because going back to Sean's point. The lower your budget is, the more it forces you to make decisions that are going to keep your audiences immersed in the project. I'll give a very quick example. There's a scene in the first Terminator where Arnold sits down at a desk and he puts his arm down and he's about to cut his arm open and examine the inside of his arm. Like it happens in T2 as well, but not to this extent.
One of the coolest scenes as a kid right. to watch.
Incredible. So Cameron talks about why that scene works, because when you set the audience up initially with a real thing, they will then take your mindset, will then subconsciously compute it and add it into reality when it turns fake. And that's why I'm talking about the Jurassic Park T-Rex thing, because when you start with Stan Winston and that thousands of pounds T-Rex for real animatronically moving, and then you cut to a CG T-Rex running, your brain, it almost like computes
there's
it in
also,
a way.
There's also the, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but there's also the way that you use it, which I think Gareth Edwards, with his background right. in VFX, is going to give his VFX the best opportunity to shine. It's the exact right. reason why the T-Rex in Jurassic Park was also always lit at night, for the most part, versus daytime shots and these giant wide shots and all this stuff. If you look at Pacific Rim, the first one was at night and underwater and was dark, and it lent itself to that. But then you go to Pacific Rim 2, which I enjoyed, a fun movie, but it turned into a Transformers movie because it was all during the day. And so it just doesn't, it's knowing how to use the effects that you have, regardless of whether they're practical or not.
Well, that's the point I'm making is like in the, so back real quick to the Cameron thing, in the scene, Arnold sits down for real. And you see him go over, put the arm down, grab the knife, and then the next shot is the fake arm being opened and examined. Because your subconscious in that moment computes that you saw Arnold sit down and then you see the fake arm,
sure.
you don't think about it. And so it's a long way of saying, like, to Sean's point, that's what makes me excited. If they go back to that mindset with Jurassic, you can bring that magic back again. And the problem is these inflated budgets and all the CG and not really paying attention to the practical, you're losing your audience. We're not saying CG's bad. We're saying use it more smartly as a filmmaker. And there are ways to do it, going back to the old days of filmmaking. And that's why those things still are great to this day. That's why
I still stand by my pitch that I made on this show a year plus ago. R-rated Jurassic Park. Michael Crichton's original novels are hard R stories. If you adapt that book, and there's enough differences. Like John Hammond is kind of a dick in the books. There's enough differences between the books and the movie where it wouldn't even be a quote unquote remake. If you were to make Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park and adapt it page for page, and you give people this really badass R-rated Jurassic Park movie. I mean, just picture it, like the Jurassic Park logo and all the letters fade away except for the R.
I'm telling you, you guys are missing out on the natural conclusion of this right now. April 4th, 2025, Fast 11. July 2nd, 2025, the crossover. Dom versus a T-Rex.
You know that exists. Life, you know that exists. Hang on. You know that exists. There's a video game. There's a video game called Ark Survival,
sponsored
which
by
is
Corona.
No, it's a video game called Ark Survival, which is like a survival game where you have to gather resources and all this stuff. Its sort of spin on the genre is that it takes place with dinosaurs, and so you have to fight and tame and live around dinosaurs. And I don't think it's out yet. I think they announced it like 2 years ago but they had him 3D modeled. They added Vin Diesel to the game because he loves the game so much.
No.
So it exists.
Amazing. It exists. That's so sweet. Wow. All right. Yeah. So we're going to wrap up episode 299. We'll be back next week with a very exciting episode number 300. A milestone episode for the Real Blend podcast, which started as an award show. Your comments down below should be, does Gareth Edwards and David Koepp involved in Jurassic have you interested in the franchise yet again? I want to hear your guys' opinion.
Which I don't know if we explicitly said David Koepp is the original writer of Jurassic Park, in case.
Yes, sorry.
Some people.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, no, and David Koepp came on the show.
He did. Yeah. It was for an anniversary, right?
Yeah, because I asked him about, I wanted to know about that, the river sequence that was cut out of Jurassic Park.
He gave us some real, drop it in as well to a link.
I actually think we had him on for a directorial effort. He wrote a movie with Kevin Bacon. He directed a horror movie with Kevin Bacon.
He didn't do Freaky, did he? Mike, you know what I'm talking about?
No, that was Christopher Landon.
Yeah, that's the guy who was going to do Scream, the new Scream.
You
should have left. Oh, okay.
David Koepp also wrote the first Spider-Man movie, by the way. See, that's what happens when we do 300 episodes. We forget all the amazing guests.
The expression we use a lot, and this sounds far dickish than I intended, but like we have forgotten about more stuff than most people ever do.
Yeah.
That sounds really dickish. You are correct.
It sounds super dickish.
great assessment, Jake. Media for more insight like that, at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show, as it has been for 300 episodes, is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week, and I guess we're still saying...
Denis.
Tunes.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big.